Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing. Be introduced to the players that are getting it done and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
Hello, everyone. Today we have a very special guest. We've got Charles Carrillo. Charles, appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So just a little bit on how we know each other. Actually, Charles has a podcast as well, and I was on his podcast a while back. And ever since, I've seen him all over social media, and I know he's big time in the investing space, so wanted to have him on and share. So with that, can you just highlight how many properties and how many units you're invested in?
Right now, as a GP, we are in four different properties, which is about just under 900 units, something like that. But we sold six or seven properties from 2022 to 2023. So we've been doing a lot more selling in the last 2 or 3 years than we have buying. So That's a good place to be.
So did you know that the challenges were coming?
Yeah. And I just didn't tell you. It was just on our own personal portfolio I had for many years. I started building in 06. I had a change of management, which was a godsend, because I remember I got a call, like literally text me the day before Thanksgiving, I think like 2021. And he's like, hey, like I'm selling my company. I'm getting rid of like anybody under like had less than 50 units. So I was like, all right, great. So I talked to my brother at Thanksgiving and we're like, oh, we're just going to sell these things, right? And sold them in early 22 to an investor. And he had some weird rate lock because it closed like in July. And I was so worried the guy was going to like, I talked to the credit union that he was getting financing from. And they're like, no, this guy's like they had like a nickname for him. They're like, no, this guy's like a really good client, blah, blah, blah. They gave him like a 90 or 100 day like rate lock on his thing. Wow. And I was like, oh, this is like insane. But it's all about relationships. So this guy had quite the relationship. So he took over he bought the properties, and that was great. And then we had some syndications, a couple in, you know, one in Atlanta, two in Tampa, some other ones. And we just, we just sold them. We had people asking us to buy, and we had two offers that came in that, for lack of a better word, you couldn't refuse. And we went above where we had projected we would go, and we didn't even finish the whole value add. We probably got on one of them, we got halfway, and the other one probably like 60%. We had some investors that weren't too happy, but no one ever complained.
when they got their check, right?
Yeah, when they got the wire, I never heard any more complaining. So that was good. But it was just a very interesting time in the market. And I just, it was like, that's just, we took some money off the table, and then we sold one in 2023.
Wow.
Just somebody came and paid. It was our last C class. And I mean, how are you going to turn down someone that's buying a 4.25 cap on a C class property built in the 60s?
In 2023, when it was very difficult. It's funny, I interviewed another guy who, he has a lot of more experience, and he's been doing it for a long time. And I'm like, what have you been up to? And he's like, I'm playing a lot of golf. I sold, before all this happened, So I'm like, good for you, right? So that's a good spot to be in. So do you do this full time, or do you also have a W-2 job?
No, I do not have a W-2. I do this full time. I do some coaching on the side as well. And then I'm partnering a business that my brother now runs full time. We have a small like online payment business, but he's been running that full time since 2019, something like this, 2018, something like that.
So talk to me about the coaching business. What does that look like, and how long have you been doing it?
I've been off and on in informally coaching students, and it's just been like, it's been when people ask me about it, and I'm like, it started off, I literally had one coaching student that would pay. I wasn't charging, but just to be nice, he'd send me wine. So he'd send me wine, and it was kind of funny. Because I was just like helping anybody that like reached out to me that I was like, I'll work with you. And we would just do a call here and there. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a formal coaching thing. And then I had an assistant of mine, and he's like, you should really put together like a formal thing. So like you have, you can actually like do this consistently, work with people. You have something. Cause I'd work with some people, like I either do a call once and then it just fizzles out. And that really made me so mad, So
why did it make you mad?
Because if like, the money's one thing, but it does filter out people that aren't serious. You know what I mean? So like, if I tell you to do something, right? Or like, you know, I've all these different things I'm showing you, you know what I mean? That telling you to do this and you don't do it, you know what I mean? And then you just like ghost me or something. Then I'm like, I was just so putting a formal way together. And that way, if people came in, it's like, I won't say like a filter, but it's really like a filter, you know what I mean? So I can work with just one or two people, you know what I mean, at a time. And that's kind of like what I do. I think I'm working with three right now, but the goal is like right around that, you know, 2 to 4 number. So I don't have to, I'm not trying to be a full-time mentor or coach, but it's something that's like, if you're working with people that are serious and especially people that are trying to get started, because I remember that back in the day, like buying my first like small commercial multifamily. And it was nerve wracking. So it's something that if you have someone that can help you with it, but it's one of those things that someone ghosts me, I'm like, that's it. It's like, it's done. You know what I mean? Like,
look, it's interesting because I met with another syndicator that's been in the business for a long time. And he told me something similar. He's like, Darren, man, I had so many of these, hey, can I pick your brain calls? And I'm happy to help the people. I want to help people. I get joy out of helping people, but I'd have a call and then I would never hear from them again. And I have no idea whether they did anything. And so I want to spend my time on people that are actually going to do something. So he started to charge because it was a way for him to filter out the people that were really serious.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll do like a short call here or there with someone, like someone that doesn't, I did a call with someone, that young kid, last week that was, he wouldn't fit into anything. I mean, I was just like, I'll do a half hour call with you. You know what I mean? Just to like, to tell you what I would think and, you know, kind of go from there. And, but usually if you charge it, then you're going to get people that are serious. And I'm getting people that like respond to emails, being proactive. And I'm like, this is like fantastic. Like this is you're, cause we're actually like, we're going to do something. I'm not just like wasting my time talking into the wind. You know what I mean?
Right. So, right. But. And that's just something I tell people a lot of times is when they're getting started and you're seeing it, you know, like when you get started, you're thinking about you and your family, like how do I build wealth, you know, but then after you're successful, like there's a ripple effect. There's people that are in your network that are like, hey, how'd you do it? And then all of a sudden you help them and then they can help the next people. It's like, it's crazy how far it can really ripple out. And you know, so one person's help gets leveraged by many.
Yeah, that's exactly true. That's a great way of explaining it.
Hey, your podcast is called Global Investors, Passive Investing in U.S. Real Estate. Do you have a lot of international investors invest in the U.S.?
The first investors we had passively were people that I had, mostly ones I work with, but they were based in Europe. And we still have a chunk of people from Europe. But now it's really expats. We have, I mean, I would say 60% are US based, and then you have maybe 65% US based. And then the other 1/3 you probably have between we have expats, we have maybe foreign nationals that have come here that don't here full time, and then we have people that are completely foreign investors. And but it was something that just didn't have much information on it, and especially as someone being a syndicator, how the correct ways of bringing that money back to the United States. So having people on that have worked with these foreign investors and how they can really, because there's programs and things out there, like financing is a tough one, right? And there's more lenders out there than there were when I started the podcast that focus on it. But it's still like, if you go traditional routes, you're still like, you know, putting down twice as much money and you have to have all this additional steps ahead of what a regular typical US investor has. So that's how I had it. And now it's kind of something that how I've kind of pivoted the show is having foreign investors that listen to our show, but also explaining all different types of strategies for investing in real estate. And I think that's one of the things is that I haven't really, yes, I focus more on multifamily investing. But the thing though is that I've had people on that talk about like subject two, not really wholesaling as much, but you have other people that have like flipped thousands of houses and different strategies. So when people come, you know, they listen, I kind of want to like spread not just what I'm doing, but what other people are doing. Cause there's so many ways of making money in real estate. I think that people kind of get set into one way and, you know, you kind of have to figure out what your goals are, what your resources are, and then you make your decision on what's the best, best route.
Absolutely. So I don't know many syndicators that take in international funds. I know people that come in from Canada, but you know, international. I know a few that focus on the Asian markets. But do you have the international folks that are purely foreign? Do they form an LLC in the U.S.?
Yeah, so
that's how they typically do it.
Yeah, so typically on that initial Zoom call with myself or my partner, what we'll do is when we speak to them, we'll kind of go over exactly what their situation is. But really, the main thing is giving them an idea of probably what they'll do, and then put them in touch with CPAs and attorneys that we know work with them. Most of them are, because I'm based in South Florida, so the majority of them are down in South Florida, Miami or Fort Lauderdale, that where they will really focus on international investors coming in. And typically what it is they set up an ITIN number here. So there's their tax identification number. And then as them being like, we would have an SSN. And then what happens is that they set up an LLC. And then what happens, obviously you get your EIN with that and they set up a bank account. And now that is their, you know, like you have a holding company, you know what I mean? Right. That is their holding company where they're going to be doing everything through. Yeah. And then making sure that this is a big thing I preach with investors, no matter what business you're in. Like, don't take any money. Don't take like foreign wires coming into your business. You know what I mean? Have it go through. If they have a U.S. entity, it's going through that. If they just have their own name that's connected to their ITIN number here in the United States, then they invest through that to you. Like, don't take any international funds. You know what I mean? Because then you're on the hook for vetting that. And you just don't have, I mean, syndicators just don't have access unless you're like a REIT or something like this. You know what I mean? Like, right. You just don't have access to what Bank of America has or other right. Wells Fargo, whatever it is, you know, the big four. So the thing though is that let them open up an account at any bank. They've done their due diligence. The money comes to you. Hey, I mean, if, you know, I got the money from Bank of America. If it's good enough for Bank of America, it should be good enough right. for me. You know what I mean?
That makes sense.
Yeah. Also, there's delays too. I've had that. Sorry. One more thing is like the delays from getting money internationally. It's not like what you watch in movies or anything like that. It usually takes multiple days, especially for large amounts. And there's invoices showing why the money's coming in back and forth. If you've got, you know, everybody waits the last day to send in their money for the syndication, right? So you want to make sure having that, you know, if it's in the States already, it's not going to be a problem going domestic to domestic. So that's another thing for syndicators, because I've had people that had pull money out of their own pocket to wait for wires to come in. And I had somebody that actually they took money from a foreign investor. It was like $500,000. They actually couldn't close that day, and they had to pay the seller an extra $100,000 to extend it out because they lost $100,000 for not having that. So these are all different things that you're getting into when you're dealing with entities and people that are maybe not based in the United States.
Yeah. So I've seen the delays both from being an investor LP in deals and also GP and looking and getting money from investors. On the retirement funds, you know, sometimes that can be a delay. They're transferring money from one IRA into a self-directed IRA, and that takes time, or into a solo 401k, and so that whole process can take time. So you've had a lot of deals, you've sold a bunch of deals, you have a few deals, you know, that you're still managing. What are one or two learning lessons that you could share with listeners?
I think in the beginning, I tell new syndicators, it's like when you're raising money, so don't be swayed by large investors. You know what I mean? It's something that if someone tells you they're coming in with a large amount of money, just kind of don't work that into your numbers, and then raise 50% more. And I think it's better to have a bunch of 50, 75, $100,000 investors, but when you start getting over that, especially on your first deals, because the chances are someone's going to come and write you a check for $250 or $500 unless you know them very closely. It's going to be something that it doesn't really happen that much. So I think it's better that if you're coming in, you're raising money, raise 50% more, because a lot of those people are 100% more, whatever you want to call it, 50% is going to cut out. And so it's important to have that money raised. And then, you know, also that wasn't a mistake. I didn't really have too many investors in my first syndication that kicked out. I think I had one person. But the thing that was that my partners that I was working with, they had investors that weren't as firm as they led on in the beginning. So that was one thing. If you're partnering with people in a syndication, which you probably are, not that, you know, this is a very dicey situation, because you don't want to give up, you know, no one wants to give up their investor information, right? However, it's really, you have to kind of see what the numbers are for these people and if they've got some large number of investors. So if everybody says we're bringing in $500,000 each to raise $2 million, and, you know, if I see that somebody shows me that they're getting 250 and 250, that's going to make me a little bit weary, right? And so on your side, maybe, you know, you have to tell them, hey, you got to find new investors, find some more investors, or I'm going to quietly on my side, go back out and start getting soft commitments. And that's something we had to end up doing. But the thing though was it was, you know, I wish I had known that up front, that it wasn't how solid people sold stuff wasn't really. So once you get a track record, that becomes less of an issue. You know what I mean? But in the beginning, that's one thing. And the money's always an issue in the first one. I mean, it's just, you know, it's very difficult to raise money, especially where we are today. But even years back for your first, and rightly so. I mean, if you've never done a property so large and stuff like that, people are going to be a little bit more hesitant. So I think that's a really important thing is, you know, oversubscribe. And then it feels much better when you're kind of turning people away and putting them on a wait list. It makes it easier for your next raise anyway.
Absolutely. Those are all great points. I mean, I remember I was, before getting into this space a long time ago, I was on a trading desk selling large loan portfolios. And actually, if a bank was looking at purchasing a loan portfolio and then it traded away to a different bank, it was so much easier the next time you put one in front of them, because they realized that it, I think it's human nature. Like, I remember my first deal, my first LOI I put in, I was like nervous. Like, did I over, pay? And the deal traded away to somebody else, and I partly was glad to see where it cleared. And, you know, I didn't get that deal, but I knew, hey, I was pretty close, you know, to the price. I wasn't overpaying. And so that gives you some confidence. And I think the same thing happens with investors, that sometimes it gives them confidence if they're on the wait list. I'm sorry, but we can't accept you.
Yeah. You know? And if something's sitting around for a while, then you're worried. It's like how many times you look at something on the MLS, and if you look in the history, you know, you see that it's on and off, right? They know that after like 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks of something that's not going like contingent or pending or something like this, there's an issue. So it's something where you see something, it's like, it's gone off. Then it went back on at 1% difference. Then, you know what I mean? They keep on, because if it sits on there for, you know, 200 days or something, then people are like, something's wrong with this property. I'm not even going to inquire.
Right. You're absolutely right. In terms of the large investors, you know, I think it's all about setting expectations, right? So if you're partnering with somebody, a good point that you brought up is, you know, ask them, you know, if there's two 250 guys, well, have you transacted with these guys before? You know, are they in any of your other deals? Because you're counting on that money. And now all of a sudden, not only do they are they not able to raise the money, but you have to go scramble.
Yeah.
So.
This episode is sponsored by Cashflow Portal, real estate syndication software that accelerates capital raising. I'm both an LP and a GP in many multifamily deals. I've used many different software applications for the capital raising process, and I like Cashflow Portal the most. I'm so confident in the software and the Cashflow Portal team that I've become an investor in the company. If you are a syndicator looking for a software platform, then let the Cashflow Portal team know that you heard about them on Darren's podcast, and you will automatically receive 3 months off an annual contract. You can find the company at cashflowportal.com.
What else? Any other learning lessons? So that was in the beginning. What about managing the deals?
So what we found with asset management is, so one thing is when we're partnering, we want to make sure that who's ever the end property manager, because now it's the same thing I do with passive deals now, as I've gotten a little bit more seasoned in passive investing, is you're looking at the group, but you're also looking at the property manager, and you're looking at the relationship they have with them. Because at the end of the day, you have all these large, flashy assets, and really there's someone that's making probably less than $50,000 a year that's really running the office, that's speaking to the clients, that are actually paying their bills, that keep this whole thing going. You know what I mean? So knowing that property manager, I mean, knowing who they're hiring, if you're going to have a say in that, that's going to come on your property. And, you know, changing property managers, and I've done it before personally. Thankfully, we haven't had to do it on a syndication deal. I had partners that wanted to on one of them, but we didn't. We ended up selling, and it was fine. They just wanted to put their own management in. There wasn't really an issue. But the thing though is that it's a hassle. It's very very time consuming. It's very expensive. There's funds that are in accounts that you don't have access to. It's just, you know, it's difficult. So it's something that knowing the management and when you're making your investment decision, that's one thing I would have. And running those when you're working with that manager, making sure that you're getting timely reports back from them. That was something that we had on a project we sold last year. And it was something that, you know, we always got delayed reports. So getting in, we made like such an effort, hey, get these reports to us Monday. They come in Monday night. And then we had the call with them and it'd be on Tuesday because you get me Tuesday morning. I can't check it before your call. So you're getting in, you can review it with people, you know what I mean? Check it through on Slack. And then when whoever is doing the call, we can actually go and go through why we're having, you know, how we're going to change where we're getting leads from, you know what I mean? Like where we're going to put our advertising dollars, stuff like this. So that's one thing you're having is just getting updated reporting to know exactly where you are. And really looking, you know, not just where it is currently, but, you know, what is your 60, 90 days? So how many leases do I have coming up in 60 days, 90 days? And then you have to put together all this data and really make the decision of how many units you're really going to turn. You know what I mean? So if you've got 10 units that are vacant right now or coming up in the next 30 days, we're going to renovate two of them. We're going to re-rent four of them. Or, you know, all this kind of stuff that you can, what you're doing with those units as they're coming around. And that's going to make it much easier, much more thorough. So you know how many units you actually have to rent for that time at one point. And, you know, so you can kind of stagger out those leases as well and, you know, stagger them around the dead season really of renting, which is really Thanksgiving to what, you know, Valentine's Day, something like that.
Yeah. So that's it, you know, 2023, you know, definitely brought it out is the operations, mm-hmm. but you know, there's so much focus on the first timer on getting your first deal, but then these are all things that you have to work through and manage as once you own the asset. And as you said, the on-site manager is key, you know, is key. So a property manager, you know, if you're new to the business, that's somebody, you know, if you pick a strong property management company, that's somebody that you can leverage to your investors. Like, this is my first time, but I'm using this property management company that has 10,000 units in this market. You know, all of a sudden they're like, oh, you know, this isn't somebody that's just, you know, looking at multifamily and doesn't know what they're doing. These guys know what they're doing. But I've had situations where we've had to change out the property management company altogether. I've had situations where we kept the same property management company, but we said, you know, we need a new on-site person. Yeah. The on-site person's not working out. So making those changes are hard, but sometimes they're needed.
Yeah. Yeah. We've changed on-site before too. And that's a difficult conversation, but it's less difficult than changing the whole management company.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you've been doing this for a long time. You've been investing since what, 2006?
Yep.
And when did you start investing in multifamily?
Yeah, my first property I invested to is multifamily. So okay. It was 2006. I grew up, my dad has been a multifamily investor since 1984. So he had all like D class and C minus properties. So he self-managed them. Yeah. So
he self-managed them. So he was going into the tough areas.
And they were not nice. Yeah.
In it was Florida just, or?
No, they were in central Connecticut. So, okay. So in a town about 15, 20 minutes from me outside Hartford. A city, let's say, outside of where I grew up. And
where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town called Avon, Connecticut. And okay. Then these were in a town.
So I grew up in Brookfield, Connecticut.
Oh, we played you guys in lacrosse. Yeah. So, so like an hour away. So it was, these were all in New Britain. So it was back then even tougher. It's not that bad now, but that's where I initially started investing in real estate. But anyway, he and a partner, they built up almost 100 units and they started selling them off in the late 90s. But for those type of properties, it's really difficult for, again, third-party management as we're on the management topic. Yeah. So he put together a team to manage them and it worked well, but they're just really, it's a really tough, everything's tough. You know what I mean? About them, the areas are tough. Some of the people you're dealing with are tough. I mean, it's just collecting rent. Everything's just makes it. That's why you look on to LoopNet and those returns, cash on cash are in like high double digits. You know what I mean? 15% because it's, I mean, They are just, I mean, they're a lot of work. They take a special type of investor to get involved with them. But anyway, it was something that, that was kind of my learning lessons going into it. And so when I bought in like a, I think it was like a C, C plus area, my first property, but he really focused on me buying better properties in better areas. And that was like a huge, he did the same thing too, after selling out like a lot of his apartment complexes. That's where he put his money into smaller multifamilies and better, more residential areas that were less management intensive, let's just say. So, but yeah, getting those properties, I just tell everybody, I mean, people send me stuff like that sometimes. You'll have new people you're working with and you're like, nope, don't even, you're going to be every 5 minutes, you're going to get a phone call. Even if you have a property manager, they're going to tell you everything. You know what I mean? And property managers can't handle that type of property because it's just like, it's just very difficult. I mean, it's, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless the, you know, the, like you said, it, Brendan's not the same as it was back then. If that market is changing, I remember sending a deal that I was looking at when I was going after my first deal, I sent this deal to a finance broker and he sent, you know, and I wanted a term sheet and instead he sent me back an article about like a, you know, something that was going on the street. And he was like, you sure you want to be here? You know? So it's, you know, they know too, what areas are strong and which ones are challenges.
Yeah. That was back in like the late 80s, early 90s, tons of gang violence everywhere. It was just like drugs run rampant. It was like a mini New York City. I mean, it was just like, there was tons of crime and everything over New Britain. But I mean, he got a lot of those properties. People signed them over to him. So back then he didn't have those pesky due on sale clauses really on a lot of these, on these properties. So, you know, you could just, he'd go like meet people at like Friendly's, all these old time landlords, and they'd send props. Everybody would like sign properties here and there and stuff like that. And, you know, it was a whole different time. All the properties were held in your name. You know what I mean? So it was completely different than it is today, but it's something that, I don't know. It's just these, I mean, and these areas, you just know because you look back on that time and you can just see the population growth that's just been just stagnant in a lot of these markets like that. And it's like, yeah, you'll get some cash flow, but you're never going to get the appreciation if you're you know what I mean? If people are moving out, you're just not going to get, even if it's a little bit, you know, even if it's not to the level of other places in the United States that have really been hit. But it's like, I mean, if there's no demand, there's no demand. It's just cash flow, which is great. But, you know, we're there for appreciation and cash flow.
Sure. So 2023 was a challenge. You got out on a lot of deals before it hit. What's your outlook for 2024? More of the same, or you think we're improving?
I mean, I think it's going to improve. I think you're going to have, I think there's going to be more transactions. I think with interest rates, if, you know, I guess if they come down, people are telling me, you know, there's going to be 3 drops this year, whatever it might be. I mean, I think if people are holding on thinking that their property that's in tough situation right now is going to improve, with say, you know, 0.5% rate drop this year or 3/4, whatever people are saying. I don't think that's going to happen. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, if your properties are, you have to start working with or doing workouts with your lenders, you know, but I think you're going to have more transaction volume because people maybe that are holding off to sell a property, they are going to come to the table and possibly think that they can get a higher price because now it's, hey, interest rates are only going down. So this is where we are right now. And, so I think there are going to be a little bit more deal volume, but, yeah, I mean, 2023, there wasn't much deals. I mean, we reviewed deals, but I mean, you get stuff that came in and you would just ultimately right off the bat know, nah, it's just like, not for us. It's not like you used to when you're like actually looking at a deal, it's checking boxes, you're going through it and you're like, okay, like this might do it. It's just like, this is too old. These are units, like, you know, just like we haven't seen the properties that we like buying coming on, and we don't buy C-class anymore. So it's something that, you know, it has to be like within that window of what we're looking at. And I don't mind paying more for good properties. But the thing though is that, you know, when you're paying more for properties that are just older properties, I mean, they're just going to need, even if you hold them for 5 or 10 years, like everybody says, you know, you eliminate issues if you hold them longer, you know, especially with like fixed debt stuff like that. And that's great. But the thing is that the property is now 5, 10 years older. So you're buying properties in the 70s built. I mean, now you've got a property that's, you know, 60 years old. You know what I mean? I mean, there's tons of issues that you're going to have to deal with during that time. Whereas buying a property built in the 1990s, you know what I mean? Where a lot of these issues aren't even there. You know what I mean? There's no asbestos, there's no lead, there's no aluminum wiring, you know, all these things that we avoid from shoddy, let's say, building back in the 70s and 80s is one of those things that you can deal with nicer properties, better properties, you know?
Absolutely. So what about geo? So over the last how many years, it's all been about, you know, the South and the growth markets. And now everything I read is the Midwest, cash flow. Like, so, you know, if we have increased transactions, is it going to turn into the Midwest, or is it going to come back into these, you know, growth markets? Because I'm in Dallas and I still see people moving here. Like, there's, you know, it's still, the population is still growing. Companies are still coming here. Jobs are still coming here. So, what's your take on that?
I mean, we have a deal in Dallas. Dallas is a great market. I mean, how do you compare a market with, you know, 50 Fortune 500 companies in? I mean, it's just like, no one's, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, they tell me about the new building, they tell me about this, and then they see a demand and it's almost like the same as a new, you know, it's just, all right, so you're telling me that, because I don't know if people in like these financial reporting understand that when I have a property built in 1990, I'm not competing directly with something that's built in 2025. Say it's just not. They're completely different people. You have right. CEOs that are coming down that are, or people, high level, 100,000 plus a year people are living in something built in 2023, 2024, right? We are renting to workforce housing people. And so if you're trying to get $2,300 a month for your property and we're getting $1,400 or $1,500 for, I mean, you're talking $10,000 difference a year. I mean, it's like, it's so you can't make many more of what we're looking at buying. So it's just one of those things where it becomes, you can't I don't believe everything I read, you know what I mean, with these markets. And like you said, I mean, I'm in Florida. I don't invest in South Florida, but it's something, Southeast Florida, but it's something that we do invest in Central Florida, and we love Central Florida. And I mean, we'll keep on looking here. There's people still moving to Florida. That's not slowing down. There's still wealthy people moving to Florida, and where wealth comes in, jobs come in, and you know, the whole trickle down thing. So, the Grandeur Atlanta, we love. I mean, so these are, I mean, I understand, but I'm not going to, if I'm working with an operator that is in one of these markets that has a team on the ground that's proven that they've done deals with, that's when I'll start looking at it. You know what I mean? Because I just don't want to go there and be like, oh, well, this is a hot market. Then this is a hot market. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, there's a lot of markets that are, I mean, there's a lot of tough markets that are in the Midwest as well, just like in other parts of it. You know what I mean? So like in here, we're not, most people aren't really buying in Louisiana or Mississippi, right? Because most of the growth in the Southeast is going to either Texas, Alabama, and, you know, Georgia, Florida, in the Carolinas, stuff like that around it. So it's something that not every area is just great altogether. And then you have to like really narrow down into the markets. So if I had, the main thing is having the team on the ground there. If we had an operation person, partner there that had successfully done deals, you know, where I'm coming in on like the fourth deal they have with the same property management company. I mean, that's just like, you know, that's like printing cash. We did a deal in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was, we were like the seventh deal with this operator. So it was something that it's just like a plug and play. You know what I mean? They've got like 1300 units around it. They have, like you said about the management company, you know what I mean? Thousands and thousands of units. So we've had no issues. It's been we assumed debt back in the end of 2021. So it's something that's like, I mean, it's just, you know, that's where we come in there and I will get involved in that market if it does that, but it's not something we totally focus on, you know, but so I think it's all about the operations people you have, the property manager, the team that they have, because that makes a good deal great, you know what I mean? And it saves you from having, you know, any tough conversations with your investors.
Yeah, that's, I'm definitely having a great, strong team on the ground is paramount. I don't know about some of these Midwest markets because I haven't invested in them. But what I do know is I owned in Dallas during COVID, and you know, some people that were in tertiary markets, when somebody would move out, they'd have a tough time finding somebody to replace them. Where in Dallas, I was like, man, somebody skips out in the middle of the night, like there was a waiting list of people wanting to get in. Like you couldn't kick somebody out for non-payment of rent, you know, by law, but you had a wait list of people. But in some other markets, you didn't have that.
that's the thing we were having conversations during COVID with property managers. And I was like leases, if anybody's like, if you have any issues with somebody, they want to leave, like they're gone. You know what I mean? Like, cause we had most of our properties that were in Tampa at that time, most of our units, and was like, they want to go, they're gone. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have to fight us. They're not going to court. Like, we can go to the office. They sign the thing. If it's left clean, they're golden. You know, good luck to them. Because we, like you said, we could rent it to anybody. And like, yes. I'm not chasing anybody for it. You know what I mean? Even if I rent it for the same rent, which you probably got more, but it's like, you're not chasing anybody when you have a waiting list. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And in some markets, it's not like that. So interesting, you know, I wanted to talk to you about the Florida market, and you're in Palm Beach. I mean, Palm Beach, the whole East Coast of Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Miami. I mean, great property, but it's very tough to cash flow in those markets. So your focus is more central, Orlando, Tampa,
Jacksonville. I-4 corridor kind of thing is what we call it. And for people that aren't from Florida or lived here, Jacksonville all the way to Tampa is really. Mm-hmm. The I-4 corridor goes through Orlando, and it's terrible to drive on, but it's great to invest into. And it's a Southeast Florida I've swore off years back for investing. I would look at properties when I initially moved down here, 2012 or something, 2013. And man, it was just like, it was insane. And it was like, and that was when all the money, international money, was really focused on the Southeast. Now it's kind of spread out around Florida and obviously other states too. But in Florida in general, it's like, you know, it's made its way up to Orlando, but it used to just be like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach, and
all of South America.
Exactly. If anyone had any money that wanted to invest in real estate, it somehow made it all into like this 100-mile stretch in Southeast Florida. And like, I would just talk to investors about like properties they lost in contract because, you know, there's a little different of a culture too, maybe not as formal. So maybe you don't have written contracts with a lot of people that are dealing. So they'd like, oh, somebody came in like 2 days later and like said they would pay cash 10% more than I was paying. And, you know, I didn't get the deal or whatever on something like this. So it was like a, you know, that was crazy. And I was like, I don't want any part of this. You know what I mean? It was just, it's a very difficult market to, I mean, I don't even know. I don't even think people even cash flowed on those properties. But if you're just looking for a place to leave money, but that's difficult to raise money for people. But yeah.
Yeah. You need patient capital. Yeah. You know, if you're just, it's just going to be parked there and, wait for it to grow. But, what do you like to do outside of work for fun?
My wife and I, we love traveling. So that's something that we spent just about a month in Europe between, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then we did, what else do we do? I love playing golf. That's something I do. That's much. I do a lot more practicing of it, trying to get better when I play. But
See, practice for me doesn't seem to get me anything. I'm like, I go out and play because I practice. I'm gonna hit him good and hit him bad, so I might as well just go do it on the course.
Yeah. It's just it's fun. You know, you get out there your first nine, you're actually serious, and your last nine, you're just kind of like falling apart sometimes. But it's fun. It's a great way of getting your mind a little bit off of what you do for work. And especially this time of year, it's beautiful to be playing down here in Florida. But those are the main couple things I do. I love doing on the side, and you know, real estate is obviously a passion of mine that I do. But you know, I love other things. Traveling, I guess it would be number one.
Well, you know, you picked a good industry to be in because it gives you the flexibility to go and do the travel, where, you know, a lot of people that, you know, are in a W-2, they get 2-3 weeks a year for vacation and that's it. And so it makes it very, very difficult. So that's fantastic. And it gives you the funds to do it too.
If you're successful.
So those two things are time and funds. So, hey, if people want to reach out to you and get to know you better, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah. If you're interested in learning more about actively or passively investing in real estate, you can go to harborsidepartners.com. And on harborsidepartners.com, I have our podcast that's on there and our YouTube channel where we do two episodes per week. One is interview format, and the other one is what I call Strategy Saturday, which is just 5 or 7 minutes just about me talking about a different strategy within real estate or about anything within the realm of real estate investing. So that'd be the great way. And if you're interested in passively investing with us, you can fill out our investor form and speak with myself or one of our partners.
Awesome. Charles, well, I appreciate you coming on. Listeners, I hope that you enjoyed that one. Until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.